Good morning. You've tuned in for the Community Character Hour. And as usual, we'll kick things off with a fun fact from the calendar provided to us by Mr. Will Valentine, if I'm not mistaken. Take it away, Hannah.
On July 4th, 1912, the newspapers read, a mysterious building labeled Menagerie, a nickel a peep, gathered in many a guileless one, until, as J.J. Donovan, its originator, remarked, some piker gave it away! Said menagerie consisted of Shetland ponies, a Great Dane dog, a freak chicken, and an indescribable cat.
An indescribable cat. Okay. Is there any further? I guess there can't possibly be any further description of this cat, can there?
There can't be. I'm really in love with the fact that he set this up as like this incredible peep show, and then it's all farm animals.
Yeah, it lured the railroad workers in, and then I imagine like Freak Chicken, the story about the chicken that they went to chop off the head, and it lived for 2 years.
Yeah. Do you know about that one? Yeah.
Whoa.
It's worth a Google.
Or like, I do kind of wonder at this point in time in Idaho, maybe a Great Dane would have been something no one had ever heard of before. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A Great Dane is a weird thing to see, even in this day and age.
Yeah.
You
know,
you rarely see a Great Dane and they always kind of catch your eye. I think I'd probably pay a nickel for most of those things. A freak chicken.
I do want to mention that this was happening in the little town of Hope.
Okay.
So just to think about all the things that Hope had going on at the time, this is going to come back a little bit later.
Okay.
That Hope's pretty cool at this point in time.
This was 1912, and, a mysterious building labeled many a guileless one. Is this your copy, or was this this was as reported?
As reported in the paper.
Awesome.
Hannah does not talk like that, for the record.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to the Community Character Hour. We're recorded. We're not live today. This is our episode for July and August of 2024. I'm Jack Peterson here from the radio station, and joining me, as always, Hannah Combs, the executive director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, the City of Sandpoint's Arts, Culture, and Historic Preservation Officer. And we are going to be talking about what was once a prominent feature of Sandpoint's shoreline. For about 60 years, there was, on the east side of town, on the western shore of the lake, I guess, depending on your perspective, a city dock, which is a little bit of an underexamined component of the city's commerce, tourism, and recreation. But before we get into that, I guess, what was the lake like before railroad infrastructure? How would you get around the lake back in the olden days?
Yeah, so back then, Sandpoint was not on the map at all, barely.
Yeah.
So I've been reading a book by Linda Hackbarth called Trail to Gold, and it talks about the mining booms that were happening in British Columbia as early as the 1840s. And back then, Seniaquitine, which was across the Pendre River from Laclede, just west of Sandpoint, that was established as a ford and ferry point across the river. And so this was on a trail that was established from Fort Walla Walla in Washington up through Spokane. And then you would come up into this area, cross the river at Seniaquitine, and then carry on by foot up to British Columbia. Later in the 1860s, there was another mining boom in Montana, which was even bigger. And there was this amazing scheme created to establish a steamboat route from Lake Pendre as far up the Clark Fork River as possible, which is an amazing story I would love to share at another time because it's really long. So eventually a steamboat route was established, and they would typically port the boats at Bayview, and then they would take the steamboats up the lake to the Clark Fork River. The town of Hope eventually became a stopping point for the boats, and then later when the railroads came in, that was one of the first kind of junctures on the railroad as well. At the same time, Seniaquatine was for a while the county seat and really significant statewide as a like legislative area. So by the time Sandpoint got established in 1882, it was way behind the other towns on the lake, especially Hope. And as Sandpoint was trying to become more than a like scrappy little railroad siding, Hope, on the other hand, across the lake, was perceived around the country as this sort of Switzerland-type resort town. So Sandpoint's city fathers were a little bit jealous of that other town on the other side of the lake.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything at Seniaquatine? What is there now across the river from Laclede?
Not much. Mm-hmm. All you can really go visit now is the cemetery, which is really cool. A lot of the old pioneer families are buried there. But beyond that, there's not really anything that remains of the original town site.
Wow. Wild.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but this is all, before people were moving around in any kind of modern sense. All this is done on horse or, mm-hmm. Horseback, by foot. A wagon, I suppose, and then ferry across the river. Because if you're going north, at some point you got to cross that water. And I guess
Right. Where
Laclede is seems as safe a place as any.
Yeah. And then, then they got the steamboats established. So they were taking the steamboats up the lake too.
Very cool. So Sandpoint comes along later than, which is kind of surprising to me, I guess. I didn't know how it. Hope and Seniaquatine already established by the time Seniaquatine or Sandpoint gets up and running. Sandpoint decides to, where does this city dock come in? Why did the Sandpoint city dock get built?
Well, Sandpoint, of course, was, and the city fathers were pretty frustrated about how Hope was getting all the attraction. I mean, they even had the peep show, right? So It's like, how can we compete with Hope?
Uh-huh.
And I think one of the challenges, too, is that Hope had naturally a deeper water retrieval point to their docks. And all of the water that was surrounding Sandpoint was too shallow to be able to handle a big steamer.
Mm-hmm. Still is more or less true, I guess, today.
But makes a great bathing beach.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. But that's less important when you're trying to build a town up from nothing. So they needed a dock, I guess, to be able to accommodate waterborne traffic on the lake.
So why would the steamboats be coming to Sandpoint if they were originally on the lake to take people to Montana? It seems like Sandpoint would have been a detour since it's so far on the west side of the lake.
Well, after the mining boom calmed down, there were still big steamboats on the lake, and they were a little bit more difficult to move off of the lake. So people found other reasons to use them, and that's when Sandpoint really started to play a role.
Would this have been before or after the railroad came through Sandpoint? And because wouldn't it just have been easier to take the railroad than to take a boat across the lake?
Yeah, well, almost a decade after the Northern Pacific Railroad was established, this would have been like 1891, a lime company called Cannon and Grace started at the south end of the lake.
Citrus? Yeah. What's a lime company?
Great question. So the southeast shore of Lake Ponderay produced some of the most profitable mining claims in Bonner County at the time, but they weren't mining gold or silver. They were mining lime, and lime is a key component for actually making concrete. So many of the historic buildings that we see in Sandpoint, but most importantly in Spokane, all of their foundations were poured using the cement derived from the lime of Lake Pend'Oreille. Huh. But that's another great story for another day.
Yeah,
how we helped build Spokane.
Another thing I don't think I had any idea about was that there was a big lime deposit in this area.
Yeah, and that always surprised me that I feel like mining is kind of a part of the history of any town in the West, mm-hmm. but I would never have guessed that that was mm-hmm. our most profitable mining export.
Yeah.
Right.
Other natural resources.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
So the lime company, how does that relate to Sandpoint at the time?
So I think this is such a savvy business move. So they established their lime mining in 1891. Mm-hmm. The following year, they built a mill called Box and Barrel to build containers for the product at the southernmost area of where the Humbird Mill would eventually be located. So this is going to be in Sandpoint, just north of the city beach area. Mm-hmm. This lime company sets up a sawmill to build boxes. And so I'm guessing how this would have worked is they would have built boxes or crates in Sandpoint. Then there would be a steamboat where they would ship these boxes by boat to their operation at the south end of the lake. They would pack the lime into the boxes. They would ship it back by boat to Sandpoint, where it could be loaded onto a train
uh-huh.
and shipped to Spokane or beyond. And then the whole cycle would start over again. So the proximity of the box making next to the railroad track helped them, do this kind of cyclical service where they were never wasting one of these boat trips. Like the boat was always transporting something.
Yeah. And didn't have to go all the way to Hope. To do that.
It's amazing.
It is.
Well, in April of that year, they built a wharf by their mill so their boat could land there. And we presume it operated peacefully for the next decade. There were also various references in the local paper to steamers at the wharf. We're not sure if Cannon and Gray had exclusive use of the wharf or if other steamers were allowed to dock there too. But in 1901... Humbird Lumber Company set up their mill and built their own docks north of Cannon and Gray Wharf. But due to the scale of Humbird's operations, this is probably a private dock. But mm-hmm. there's a really interesting article from 1904 on January 15th from the Northern Idaho News. It states, "There is a great deal of business on Lake Pend'Oreille, which is not coming to this point because of a lack of docking facilities. Hope has the bulge over Sandpoint in this respect because of its natural deep water harbor. Sandpoint has got to go out to the deep water because nature, when it's passed out the great inland, gave to Sandpoint site a bathing beach, the finest in the land. But a bathing beach is not a good harbor, and the deep water has got to be built too." They go on to say that the city should build the dock because if a private company builds it, they will charge for docking privileges, which they say none of the boats can afford. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and especially because the steamboats were originally launched on the lake as a very profitable scheme back in the mining days. But now, 45 years later, it sounds like we have all of these older steamboats that they've tried to repurpose in some way after the mining boom died, but the maintenance costs on them are probably pretty high, and they can't charge everyday citizens nearly as much for passage as they could charge these hopeful miners back during the mining boom.
Got it. So the city takes a gamble that if they build it, business will come. They were expecting taxes from generally increasing from the increase of business, and they were hoping that it would pay for the dock, and they urged themselves not to be too short-sighted on that.
So how and where did they actually build it?
Mm-hmm. So just like with the tourist parks we talked about last month, the mm-hmm. first hurdle was negotiating with the all-powerful railroad companies. Yeah. Now, initially, Northern Pacific was surprisingly amenable to the idea. On June 10th of 1904, the Northern Idaho News states, L.D. Farman and John Marshall went to Spokane Monday, where they had a conference with A. Beamer, division superintendent of the Northern Pacific, with respect to the construction of the dock. Mr. Beamer stated to the gentleman that the railroad was favorably disposed toward Sandpoint and that it was their intention to make it their summer resort for Spokane. Concerning the dock, he said that the railroad company would be willing to have the village secure all the timbers they wanted when the piling was removed at the old bridge. So they had recently rebuilt the original railroad trestle across the lake, and they had built the new one in concrete. So they had all of these old timbers still sitting out in the water, and they're offering that to the city if they want to repurpose them for the dock. It goes on to say, "This will be quite an item, as there is a good deal of material that can be secured. In addition, Mr. Beamer stated that the railroad would give $500 toward the construction of the dock and give the village the right-of-way to the landing."
So they were recycling timbers from the old railroad bridge.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But there was a holdup. So they seemed pretty happy donating the timber. They were going to invest some cash into this. Mr. Beamer stated that the bridge would not be removed until early in the winter. So the city decided to, for the meantime, build a floating dock. They would then put pilings under it when they were available from the railroad the following year.
Wow.
This seems like an immense amount of work to just like jump the gun and say, we're going to build the dock, but we're not going to support it with anything. It'll just sit there until we can drive piles in next spring.
Right. I mean, it's a, that seems like quite a scheme and a little bit of a gamble.
Yeah. And then at the same time, the Northern Pacific also agreed to tear up their sand spur. And this would have been like a little side track that they would use to extract sand from the beach. Another good story for another day. But it would have been in the way of building the city dock as the city wanted it to be built. So the NP agreed to tear up their sand spur, and I love this, citing that they could build a better one in hope. So just another little...
Hope is winning again.
Another little slap in the face.
The upper hand.
So like all things, when you're talking about the railroad or any kind of construction projects, really, the holdup took a year longer than they originally expected. But by February of 1906, the lumber for the pilings was finally delivered to the site. And again, we're looking at this area kind of just north of City Beach, where the Windbag Marina is today. So while waiting for the ground to thaw that spring, as they're getting ready to drive the piles in, the Northern Pacific makes a little bit of a fuss. They had originally magnanimously offered the city the right-of-way to the dock. And what this means is this dock was so long, so it was hundreds of feet out into the lake to reach deep enough water to for the steamboats to land. That was the idea. But then they also wanted people to have easy access to it from the shore. And that didn't just mean from the beach. They wanted it to connect all the way over to the old part of town. So they were actually trying to build it all the way up to the railroad and then have like a path so people could cross the railroad tracks and go straight out onto the dock.
Yes.
Now, NP originally says, great idea. And then when they start building, they're like, actually, no, we don't like it. So they rescinded their offer and they made the city sign an easement that it had this clause where the Northern Pacific could revoke the agreement at any time and demand that the city demolish the city dock if it no longer suited the railroad.
Wow.
Powers that be.
Yeah. So by May, the pilings were in place. And so the main structure was there. They just needed to lay the planking on top and then construct a railing. And I think the railing is significant because it tells you this isn't a dock that's like at water level.
Yeah. Okay. So they finally finished it then.
They did. Yeah. Okay. So this thing was tall. When you look at the old photos, I didn't bring my ruler, but it looks like it probably would have been like 15, 20 feet above the water level, depending on the time of year.
Such an amazing feat, understanding that that sand is like quicksand and you have to go so deep to hold any type of structure.
Yeah, definitely. So you asked if they actually finished it?
Yeah. Did they finish it at that? So after the easement was signed, that's when they finally got it finished?
Oh, no.
Okay.
So the Northern Pacific kept going back on the agreement to the point, I think this is significant, that the city sent whom they called Village Attorney Johnson to Spokane to duke the matter out with the Northern Pacific's legal counsel.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This sounds like a big deal. Remember how the city set up a citizen tax force to clean up the tourist park rather than hire the attorney? So this must have been like a big thing.
I mean, I just think of the all-powerful Northern Pacific at their headquarters in Spokane, and here comes Village Attorney Johnson.
With his little briefcase.
Yes, his little country hat on. And he's
meeting at the Davenport Hotel.
That's right. They don't even call him City Attorney Johnson. Village Attorney Johnson.
Yeah. He's not a full-time position. They only call him in once every 3 years. When
that's
like,
right.
Oh, I guess we need an attorney for this.
Johnson?
Yep. Okay, so they send the lawyer. They send a lawyer, Village Attorney Johnson, down to Spokane to face the Goliath of the Northern Pacific Legal Council. And what ensues?
So by the end of July, it seems they had finally resolved their differences.
Okay.
The city hired an engineer to build a 1,500-foot-long, 16-foot-wide permanent structure with a 60-by-70-foot floating dock at the end. So the main part of the dock would be anchored in the ground, but then they have this really cool like platform out at the end that can kind of bob around in the water. The NP, oh gosh, so the NP sends them a note saying that they would send their, I quote, bridge engineer here in the very near future to go over the dock proposition with the council and give them the benefit of his suggestions. So they want to make sure that they still have a voice in how this is going to go down.
It's not much different than today, I have to admit.
So by September, the dock was finally complete, and City Council voted to keep the dock free for all users, whether commercial or just everyday residents. They hired a dockmaster as a city employee.
Which I think I would do pretty well at. I could be the dock master.
Totally.
Yes. Yeah.
You just have to have like the right hat, I think.
Again, yeah, it does come down to headgear, I think, but I think I could do it. Headgear. Okay, so finally this dock is built and you 1500, so this is like a quarter mile, more than a quarter mile long out into the water.
It's incredible to see that on a map how much it stuck out there.
It's finally built and now what? What are we doing with this dock now that it's here?
Well, during that time, there were about 80 to 100 steamboats that were on the lake. And this was the only way that you could stop and get to Sandpoint in that regard. And by 1907, steamers were hosting lake excursions, leaving from city docks. They ran ads like, "The steamer Defender will leave the city dock at 7 a.m. Bring your lunches. Don't forget your wife or lady friend. Fare, $2 per couple." And then there were also fraternal organizations like Shriners and the Woodsmen who booked excursions for their group picnics. And then fishermen would unload their hauls there and then the boats would deliver mail. So it was really pleasure and for definitely utilitarian uses.
Yeah, you could, again, to give you an idea of the scale of the dock, you could drive a horse cart or later an automobile onto the dock. And it was theoretically wide enough to turn a vehicle around at the end, though I don't think I would have been brave enough to try it.
Yeah, that seems a little dicey. It seems like this would have been kind of a, this is like one of the main kind of draws and a main gathering place of the city. You could say, let's meet at City Dock, like you might say at, say, Schweitzer Clock Tower today, or well, let's meet at Farman Park or City Beach or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. People were coming there for so many different reasons, for work, for leisure, that it totally would have made sense as a meeting place, or like the gateway to the city by water.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for boaters either. The dock was the home of the original Longbridge swimmers. But perhaps we call them the long dock swimmers. Some of our earliest photos of people swimming in the lake were particularly women, and they would swim off the side of the dock. And I love it because they're in their like wool swimsuits. It's pretty amazing. And then one of the maps from 1909 shows the area just south of the dock labeled white sand bathing beaches. So you could swim at the nice beach or you could swim laps around the dock knowing you could hold on to the piling if you needed to catch your breath.
Okay.
And don't forget, the city also tried to use the dock to solve its sewage problem.
Ah.
So an article from 1907 states, if a suitable site cannot be secured there, there seems to be no solution to the garbage problem except to secure a barge, anchor it at the city dock, and dump it from time to time down the river. But the city actually The city actually went for an alternate solution, though perhaps not a better one. Jury's out. So from 19, this like truly shocked me. From 1911 to 1958, raw sewage was dumped into the Pendere River via a 1,600-foot sewer pipe extending into the river from the end of Third Avenue. Somebody has told me before that there was this giant septic tank underneath the end of Third Street. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. No way.
Wow.
But now it does.
No comment.
Okay. Now it makes sense. One thing that's not really in the notes, but like this is when the lake is the lake level is uncontrolled by man anyway. Yeah. So it goes up and down and up and down. And so I'm guessing there weren't many other docks. Like right now we have docks that where you can park at City Beach and up in Sand Creek. There's the marina and things like that if you want to park your pleasure craft.
Mm-hmm.
But this was like the main dock. Yeah. For the city at the time.
So I imagine the raw sewage was just the fertilizer for the grass. So the cows and the sheep could have like amazing greens. That's it.
But yeah, no, that's a good point. I think that's most significant because today you look around the lake and everyone has a private dock that has a house on the lake, right?
Mm-hmm.
But back then, people were a lot more hesitant to build a house right next to the lake because the water was uncontrolled by the dams. Mm-hmm. And so it would have these natural flood cycles. And so you typically just, you know, it was risky to build your house right on the water. And so people wouldn't have these private docks everywhere around the lake.
They were just giving away lakefront property back in the day.
Totally.
Which makes me think, though, Lakeview Cemetery. Mm-hmm. How did that work with flooding?
It is actually...
Is it pretty high?
When I've been down there, it is pretty high above the river.
So there was some strategic thought behind that one.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lake... What is that? That's Division Street does go down.
Amazing pioneer cemetery.
Yeah.
Gotta love a good cemetery.
Those listeners who will recall our last episode, we talked about tourist parks and kind of the tourism boom in the early part of the 20th century. And if you want to go back and listen to it, you can find that on our website, krfy.org. But as they were kind of trying to establish Sandpoint as a tourist town, there was an issue with houseboats parked at City Dock, and the city was trying to clear them out. Can you tell us any more about that effort?
Yeah, I mean, we had to figure out who these people were that, you know, were so intrepid and did not want to leave their houseboats and challenge the city. And we were lucky enough to find a little history about one man who lived in one of those houseboats. And he was born in North Dakota in 1883. And he was on his way to a farming job in Washington when he was 25. He saw the lake and decided that that's where he wanted to settle. So that, I always think of like the Long Bridge experience. Uh-huh. He must have had that. So he sent for his wife and his newborn son, and he provided a family there, here in Sandpoint by cutting wood and running the dance hall, hunting and fishing. And then in a few years, he was living around the lake in canvas tents, and then he upgraded to a houseboat. His wife and him actually had 11 children. We're going to have a little sad moment, but one died of a sickness and another drowned when he fell from the houseboat. So super, super challenging lifestyle. And then the family ended up moving around. They would squat on land in Bottle Bay, Bayview, Garfield, Glengarry, and Sunnyside. And then in 1922, he moved the houseboat to the area around City Docks. And then in the late 1910s, he had a business selling fish and smoked fish, but he was under surveillance for another business he was operating. Mm-hmm. You can imagine what it was. Moonshine. Because his houseboat was mobile, he had been able to easily hide his still in various locations around the lake. Mm-hmm. And shortly after moving to City Dock, he was nabbed by a Sandpoint deputy. After a tussle, the deputy confirmed he was carrying a jug of moonshine. Because it was a federal prohibition agent that had been monitoring him, he was actually tried in federal court. But he was adamant he had fished up the sack while cleaning up the shore near his place and was carrying it out to the deep water to throw it away. So.
Like, oh, I was just picking up litter.
Yeah, yep. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. We don't know how the case was resolved, but the man was back living in the house but at City Dock. And at some point, he was there. He was probably one of those men that was like, heck no, we won't go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is where the eviction notices come back in. This is like right around the time that Sandpoint is starting to try to oust people from the City Docks.
Task Force.
And that lasted from, oh my gosh, it was such a saga. That lasted from 1922 until when?
Well, we found out that in 1928, the city had to turn off the water to the houseboats on the waterfront to force the moving. So that was their tactic. Mm-hmm. But you can still see this man's houseboat in the photos in 1929. Because he's like, what? I'm surrounded by water.
Exactly.
Fine.
Yeah.
Plus we have moonshine. Who needs water, right?
Right. Yeah. He cut off my water. Look what the ground's made of here.
Yeah. And these are really, really hardy people that carved out our land.
I'm super intrigued that they somehow had city water on their houseboats.
It is amazing, the early utilities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because we were actually looking at the early town site, weren't we identifying like power poles and like legit utility infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
So by 1931, the city created an ordinance so they could evict, condemn, and tear down the houseboat. So this is the law. Mm-hmm. And that summer, this man and seven stubborn others were convicted of squatting on city land and fined $100 each. So I'm not a math person, but
that's like $3,000.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, that's a chunk. That's intimidating enough.
But he was moonshining, so he probably had it.
Yeah. Love these character stories.
Yeah. And he's got so Prohibition goes into effect and he's just like, I know what to do.
Yeah.
I'll build a still.
100% an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's been there.
Mobile still.
By that point, you said he moved there in 1883, right? Mm-hmm. So he'd been there for like 30 years by the time Prohibition came around. And
can we take a moment to just appreciate the idea of living on a houseboat with 11 children? This is not like the Von Trapp family where you have a fancy mansion. They can all scatter. Like 11 children on one houseboat.
I'm surprised the wife didn't jump. I'm sorry. I can't even. I can't. Like, I would have them I'd have leashes on them, I think, with like a harness so they could only go so far, or a life jacket.
That would be wise.
All mm-hmm. the time. Well, my husband grew up in Alaska, and they were timber fallers, and they lived on a floating houseboat.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was cool. They only have two kids, but I remember my husband saying, like, there were, like, docks everywhere, and it was, like, a magical time, but he always had to have a life jacket on, mm-hmm. and then he'd kind of trip and fall, and they'd just, you know, pull him up by the
straps the on strap. The life jacket.
Yeah. Shake him off.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm guessing life jackets weren't a thing then. Well, I have to look that up when we're
the
done.
Titanic had flotation.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Weren't they famously? I think they were like stuffed with sawdust or something.
Yeah.
So they were. So they floated for a little while, and then they'd get waterlogged and become more of like a death jacket.
Oh, no, a death jacket.
Yeah.
We should come back to that. We need to do some research on
Find
that.
Find a way to work that back in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some more research.
Yes.
I'm loving that.
So we had. I mean. Worth saying, we saw some photos of the docks. There was like, this isn't just a pier, a wooden pier and nothing else. You mentioned there's power going out there. We know there was sewage, or certainly there was sewage.
Let's forget that ever happened. Okay,
but there was city water going out to the houseboats on the dock, mm-hmm. and there was an office, little dock mm-hmm. house, mm-hmm. where the dock master worked. This was like a whole,
it's like our current Austin Hole, who does all of the maintenance for parks and who heads that up.
Yes. Yeah. He'd be the dock.
He has
master.
His office at City Beach.
Yeah. Totally.
It's a historic Austin,
mm-hmm. but you're right. It would have been like kind of like a little mini town all on its own.
Yes.
Out there. The dock town.
I have to admit, when you said city docks, I imagined it was like more of a community than like a legit dock, which I find really fascinating.
Yeah.
And they were down to what, seven? So they had been trying to evict people for a while. There were still seven people living there in 1931 when they finally like got rid of them. But at its peak, there must have been more than that. Probably living out at the end of the dock.
Yeah, some of the photos, I would guess you're looking at like 20 or 30 different dwelling type sheds out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. So after this point in the, around 1930, there's not a lot that we've discovered about exactly what happened. But we have all of these amazing photos at the museum. So by looking at those, you can kind of piece together, like what you were talking about, some of the features of what it would have been like to be there. And I especially love looking at some of these aerial photos, because when I think City Dock, and you know, they describe it as this 1,500 foot long pier, I'm picturing like a jetty you would see on the ocean that just goes straight out and into the horizon. But in reality, you have that. And then you have all of these other little floating pieces that people have tied together to create, like extra marinas off of the dock. And like there's a building. There was a huge
kind of like an organic circular structure around it. That's so fascinating.
Yeah. And so you have this anchor that is the permanent city dock that's piled into the ground. But then all of these little floating buildings, offices, marinas, just mooring posts and things that are all floating around it. There's one photo we found that there's a building with the words Acme Boat Works painted on the side of it. So it seems at some point they were building boats out there, which is kind of interesting.
So if they build it, if you build it, they will come theory that they threw out there.
Yeah.
I think. But they would have accomplished that with this theory. Is that what you guys are feeling as well?
Well, and you have to remember that they didn't charge anyone for mooring fees or anything. So it kind of seems like it became a little bit of a free-for-all. For like, I see an opportunity to have my boat there or start a business there.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, maybe by the time of the great houseboat eviction, the city was like, what did we do? There should have been a nominal fee, or I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, but you're right. Like you mentioned electric. There are photos of people installing street lamps on the dock going all the way out to the end.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then, yeah, they're kind of, especially as you get into that kind of mid-century time and the dams are getting built and maybe people are starting to build more on the shoreline, you start seeing a higher demand for these marinas for smaller personal vessels.
Yeah. So the dock was there until like the 70s, right?
I think kind of
there until the 70s.
It did have one great, no, it had two great collapses before then. So in March of 1969, the Sandpoint News Bulletin reported, approximately 60 feet of the tip of the old city dock was wiped out Sunday night as ice cakes pressed forward by a northerly wind sheared pilings off from under a portion of the dock and dumped it into the waters of Lake Ponderay.
Oof.
So is that when they tore it down after the collapse?
Not quite.
Okay.
So this, I had to do quite a bit of digging to figure out the end of the story. My favorite way to start digging into a project is to ask people who might have been around at the time. So
yes.
I asked one of our volunteers if she remembered the city dock when she moved to town in the mid-70s, because I was trying to figure out if it was still there at that time. She said it was. And when I asked her what she remembered about the dock, she very coyly said, skinny dipping.
Oh, my.
So I then went back to the newspapers to try to find more information. The dock was rebuilt after it collapsed in 69. And in 1970, there was an article saying that it was a popular spot for senior citizens and youngsters to fish for bluebacks. Those would be kokanee salmon. A few years later, in 1973, City Council hired consultants to conduct a study about future uses of the old dock, which was good timing because that winter, the dock was swept away in a flood.
Whoa.
They estimated it would cost about $30,000 to rebuild it, and the city requested federal disaster relief funds for the project, but the request was denied. So they spent a while trying to find other funding sources. In 1975, they burned the remains of the old dock, and they received a grant from the Idaho Department of Parks and Recreation for $180,000 to reconstruct it using fill instead of piling. So that's the rock that we see out there now. And then just a few short years later, in 78, a guy named Keith Scheckler was operating the Windbag Marina on the site, and he was running a sailing program with the local yacht club. So
amazing history.
It transformed from a steamboat site, a steamboat landing site, to the home of the local yacht club.
Yeah, and so that's Windbag that we know today.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it's kind of hidden. Like, it's not organic getting there. But when you are, when you walk it, it is so beautiful. And there was, there's beautiful public art pieces displayed there too, which I think is really fun. There's like a really nice like gateway moment, and it's one of my favorite places.
Yeah, especially in the fall when all the trees along the Bay Trail are
really
yellow.
Well done.
No, I agree.
We should do like a memorial plaque.
The old city,
for the old dock.
City dock.
Yeah. Because I bet, like, it took us so much digging to learn about this history.
And that's what is so fun about this show is that I love that we're unearthing literally from the depths of the archives. And speaking of that, I just want to celebrate Dan Evans and Will Valentine for supporting the historical research on the show, and particularly for this. I mean, there wasn't there like no organic research?
We, you know, I think we said we were researching the tourist parks, and the story came up about the city docks. Yeah,
and we're like,
we have to know more. Of course, there will be information.
Yeah, whole there was nothing. Subject file.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. So Dan really just pieced amazing. The whole thing together for us. We're so grateful.
So grateful.
Well, as we move to wrap up here a little bit, we kind of did the whole history from the construction to the destruction, and now it's Windbag Marina, or what is there now is Windbag Marina, which you can kind of come into, but you don't park at the end of usually because it's not built for that. Mm-hmm. What did we learn in summation? Folks, how does it apply to our
the education moment?
Yeah, how does it apply to our city as it stands today?
Well, I think City Dock is one of those things that is largely overlooked. You know, it's in the background of a lot of photos, but it's rarely ever the focus.
Mm-hmm.
It's vaguely mentioned in a lot of stories, but it's hard to find the ones that really talk about it.
Yeah,
and so I think as we were kind of planning this whole series, we were like, we're going to jump from this to this, but what is this city dock that's just kind of like hiding back there?
It changed that landscape forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the history of what we see today visually as Windbag Marina,
mm-hmm.
as I gaze out and look at it, I'll always remember city docks.
It would be cool to be down at the beach and to look out and see instead of Windbag, just to see what it would have been like.
I wish we could have like the virtual layers, maybe in the future with technology, right?
I mean, if you go out to the end of Windbag Marina and you're standing there looking out at the lake and you're probably going to see some sailboats, you're probably going to see some motorboats out there, but imagine this huge 100-foot steamboat coming toward you.
Crazy.
And docking, and you're 20 feet above the water and you're on level with the deck of this boat and you're out to go on a fancy picnic on the other side of the lake. You just can't do that in the same way anymore.
And then in the early photos you see the Humbird Lumber Company with all of the wood in the water too. Yeah. So then you're also traversing like industrial like function and in your wool bathing suit.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we think of the lake today as almost exclusively like just an amenity for recreation, but it kind of ties it back to when the lake was, you know, when it was important to be on the lake because that's how you got from place to place.
Industry.
It was a real a real industrial resource to be able to move things up and down the river and up and down to the different towns on the lake, including that dastardly Hope over there.
We love Hope. We do.
Well, there you have it. We have done it again. We are drawing near the end of our time together. What are we planning to talk about next time?
I think we can commit to this one.
Okay.
Okay.
City Beach.
Excellent.
Mm. Yeah. Perfect. What we know today.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Perfect one for what will probably be our last show of like really hot summer weather.
Yeah.
I guess.
So, it's so hard to think.
Yeah.
I just haven't done enough lake time.
Mm-hmm. Well, get out there, run down the end of the dock and jump in.
But maybe not at the end of the 3rd Street Pier, because now we know what that was used for.
Yeah. Just don't drink the water.
That is very interesting, too. Yeah, the 3rd Avenue Pier. Okay. Let's talk about what's going on in your various organizations. Heather, what's happening at the city?
Oh, my gosh. So many exciting things. But the pieces that I would really like to highlight right now would be our call for information that we've launched. The Arts, Culture, and Historic Preservation Commission is trying a new way to collect the history of the community. And we're currently working on revamping the walking tour and making it more enriching and making sure that we're capturing all the historic places within commercial and residential. And so We, on sandpointidaho.gov, our website, and also on the museum's website, too, you can click a link and share your residential knowledge through a historic lens, of course. So you don't have to own the home. If you have a story, we encourage you to please document it through that form. It is just for education purposes only, and the beauty is, if you so choose to, it will forever be recorded in the museum's archives, further enriching our residential histories, which is so important. It's exciting. Like, it's working. It's fun. We've already gotten one ghost story. Winning. So, yeah, very fun. So please participate.
Okay. How do we do that? It's on...
Yep. So City of Sandpoint's website, sandpointidaho.gov. If you go under news, there's a cute little button that you can click, and then there's a link. You can also get to it through the museum's website as well, and I'll let Hannah speak to that. And then we also, speaking of the walking tour brochure, we have our amazing walking tour this Friday, July 26th at 10 a.m. You meet in front of our historic theater, the Panada. It's free to the community. It's about an hour. It's amazing. It's led by our incredible historic storytellers from the Lake Pend'Oreille Repertory Theater in the museum.
Cool. And what else is going on at the museum, Hannah?
Yeah, well, we are quickly approaching the final month of our weekly historic walking tours, which meet at Elevate Realty on First Avenue every Friday at 2:30. Those tours last about an hour, and they talk about a lot of the families that used to live in Sandpoint in the early days. And you can find information about those on our website, bonnercountyhistory.org. We're also so excited to be collaborating with Boy Scouts Troop 111 at the County Fair this year. So that's August 13th to 17th. And our curator, Olivia Fee, has been training Boy Scouts from Troop 111 to conduct oral histories. And so they're really excited. It's their 90th anniversary,
wow,
which is incredible. So they're going to be at the fair in their booth, doing little 10-minute interviews with people about their lives here in Bonner County. So if you are have old stories to share, especially if you used to be a Boy Scout, stop by at the fair. That'll be every morning from 10 a.m. until noon.
That's so cool.
Very cool. All right. Were you guys in Scouts? Either of you?
Oh, no.
It was like a brownie for a moment.
Mm-hmm. I did 4-H.
I did 4-H, too.
Hey, okay.
I love 4-H. So well, we love the fair.
Yes.
Big fans of the fair. Yeah, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, civic organizations, the fair.
Yeah. Would you have lived in a houseboat on City Dock if you could have?
At that time?
At that time. Mm-hmm.
Not with 11 children.
No.
Definitely not.
Certainly not. Well, I think it would have been cool. I would have done it.
Yeah.
For a little while, anyway.
I think I would have been like a flapper, maybe enjoying the the libations.
I think living in the old...
Well, it seems like the place to go, especially during Prohibition.
Because there were a lot of like houseboat parties. Uh-huh. Oh. And they would... Like, I remember there were these little steamer parties that would go around the lake.
Mm.
And then, so I'm fantasizing, but the museum has, isn't it true? I remember back in the day, the scuba divers would like come and like bring in relics that they find at the bottom of Lake Pend'Oreille. Mm-hmm. And there's this like amazing encrusted cash register. So I was like, it was probably like on a party boat. And we're all dancing, and then someone comes, and we have to throw over the, I don't know.
Uh-huh. Keep working on it. I like where it's going.
Yeah. I like the idea of just being out there, and you see that, you know, if you're his neighbor, I imagine you know that the guy is coming back from his still with a full you know, with a full crate of moonshine. And here comes the party barge to the end of the dock.
Hence, like, the seven people that just clanned together.
Right, yeah, just hanging out, coming back to the neighborhood. I think it would have been a lot of fun in, like, June, July, and August, and then not so much fun most of the rest of the time.
Yeah.
I think, like,
especially,
hanging
and
out
in weather and stuff.
Yeah. Like, if you could be in the Whitaker house, which was, like, a huge mansion, kind of at the shore where the dock comes into town.
Mm-hmm.
Being in there, looking out over the dock.
Yeah, but not that's exactly swamped. Where I was feeling too. Yeah. Like, I would like to look at the water in a fabulous house.
Okay.
We'll come down and visit Jack and have a fish fry.
Okay. Yes. Sounds good. I would be there. I would solve mysteries. Or maybe I could be the village
detective.
What was it? Yeah, I could be the village detective. I was going to say the
village attorney.
Yeah, that's
Johnson.
Yeah. What was it? Village attorney Johnson. He lives down by the docks. Go ring the bell at the end of it, at the end of the dock, and he'll boat over and paddle over in his canoe. Okay, we are. This has been the Community Character Hour. We talk about mainly the city of Sandpoint, but also just the North Idaho area. Heather Upton is the City of Sandpoint's Arts, Culture, and Historic Preservation Officer, and Hannah Combs is the Bonner County Historical Society and Museums Executive Director. I'm Jack Peterson. We broadcast here at 8 a.m. on the second and fourth Monday of the month, and we'll be back next month to talk about City Beach, so tune right in. Thank you for joining us here on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio, and now I guess we're going back to a little music to finish out the hour.